Well, hello everyone. I am Billy Tees. Welcome to our podcast. I'm coming at you today for Shore House Books, HO Press, and Humor Outcast Radio. On the phone with me today, I have Mary Farr. How are you doing today, Mary?
Well, hi, Bill. I'm wonderful. Thank you. Nice September day here in Minnesota.
Oh, great, great. Yeah, we're here in Ohio, we don't have too many great days after this. You know, we have two seasons here, the July and winter. Mm-hmm. Those are the two seasons we have here.
Oh, my goodness.
Mary, Minnesota's probably pretty cold, too, I bet. Mary is
you
the...
Know, go ahead. It isn't too bad. Mm-hmm. Excuse me.
Oh, you're fine. Mary is the author of a book entitled, If I Could Mend Your Heart. And in essence, what this book is about is how to deal with grief, how to help other people get over things. And it's not just death. And we're going to talk about that in a little bit. It's not just the loss of life, but it's about any type of major change that you may have in your life, whether it's a bad divorce or maybe you've lost your job, something like that. And before I get into this, I just want to tell everybody straight up that this is not going to be a depressing podcast. This is not about being sad. And this kind of feeds into, now this is my opinion, but it's kind of, to me, we have a tendency to, something in our psyche, we have a very unhealthy concept of what death and change is. This whole thing about the Grim Reaper and everything, I feel that's very unhealthy. And it's a part of life, and it's something that we all have to deal with at one time or another. So we should have a good way of processing that. And that's kind of what we're going to talk about here on today's program. Before we get into all of that, Mary, I just wanted to give you an opportunity to tell our audience exactly a little bit about you. What are you passionate about, your career-wise? I know you have the horses. So would you like to tell us a little bit about that?
I can tell you about the horses, and I can also tell you that my career has actually been a two-pronged one.
Okay.
excuse me, one in hospital ministry, and you'd call that chaplaincy or pastoral ministry, and the other is in hospital business development and communications.
Okay.
So I've been both at the bedside and at the administrative level and continue to do that. I continue to do both, in fact. But I love horses. I guarantee you I'm not gloomy. My friends would tell you that would be an incorrect assumption. And I also don't take grieving lightly.
Right.
But I do feel it is a process and part of our lives, and we see it more often than we probably admit. And some things can make it a little easier, both to be on the receiving end and be on the supporting end.
Okay. What is it about horses? There's something about women that they just love horses. Is it like the freedom, or what exactly is it about horses?
Well, I don't know that I would have ever said it was the freedom, but my poor parents, I'm surprised they lived through it, because I was demanding a horse when I was way too young. And it's a companion, too. It's a friendship. If kids like horses, they usually love them.
Right.
And it's a disease that rarely goes away. It hasn't with me. I was showing horses before I was 12.
Okay.
And I've enjoyed all different disciplines, from dressage to cow horses.
That's fantastic.
I still do.
I have a thing for cats. It's not as exciting as horses.
I love cats too.
Okay. Getting back to the subject of your book here, I know that when someone dies, a lot of times they'll get a sympathy card, and there's other things that companies do now with electronics. You can get an email, a sympathy card. I'm not sure how sincere that seems, but there's a lot of things that people can do to do that. Now, as far as your book is concerned, how is what goes on in your book different from what we might consider the traditional approach to condolence?
Well, I think that I've thought about that since you asked me that question earlier. There are all kinds of wonderful sympathy cards and condolence cards and things that are done in very good taste and perfectly appropriate. And there also are tons of books on, some on research, some on kind of how-tos. But I have the feeling, at least in my experience, that when somebody is in the initial stages of a loss or an upheaval, they're likely, and while they would enjoy and appreciate a card, They're not really likely to read a book, at least a substantial book.
Right.
That might come later. So there's nothing wrong with any of it. But this, what I've done, is something that I would call in between. So it isn't just a statement. It's actually a little story that walks a person through the honoring the grief, using genuine language that doesn't insult the grief.
Right.
And then what I like to do is shine a light on the path toward healing. So that doesn't mean they're going to be all healed when they're done, but it's like a walk, like a short, quiet walk.
Okay. That's a good way of putting it. And as we talked about earlier, this book is not just about death, okay? Obviously, the loss of life is probably one of the more traumatic things that we can go through, but a lot of times it may be a divorce, it may be the loss of a job. And I can tell you, you know, there's been a lot of discussion in the corporate world about how men view that environment as opposed to women. And in my opinion, this is my opinion, but I would have to say that men in that environment a lot of times have an unhealthy attachment to their job. You know, their job becomes a part of their essence. If the stock market would happen to crash tomorrow, I can almost guarantee you it would be almost all men that were jumping out the window. So it can be a very impactful thing when you've been at a job for a long time and you lose it. So could you maybe expand on this a little bit? What do you think is important to bring light when we consider, to bring light to the subject, when we consider the subject of loss?
Well, I think you nailed it at the beginning of our discussion here, and that is that loss is about a lot more than a death or getting sick. And what happens when people have a loss is they kind of don't expect all the other losses that go with it. So you just gave a good example. If I remember losing a job not too many years ago, and I didn't even like the job very well, but you know, I kind of liked going there, and it was a routine, and there were people that I enjoyed there. So there were all kinds of feelings of isolation now, having left that space.
Right.
And so there are just a lot of things that happen, and of course that can be loss of money, loss of confidence.
Oh, sure.
So I always feel these losses have multiple pieces to them, so it isn't just one thing.
Right.
And, you know, as a result, it's pretty important that we sort of look around and recognize that and make sure that we have some way of filling the gaps or getting back to center or the kinds of friends who support us and help us rebuild those things that go missing when we have a loss. So
right.
It really does apply to a lot of our lives, and I think it's really important to look at it for whatever reason we're grieving.
Right. And I know when someone is going through that, I sometimes have some hesitation approaching them. It can be very awkward. Let's say someone just experienced the death of a loved one, or you know they've lost their job and they're just absolutely destroyed by it. They're worried about their income and paying for their kids' school, and they're going through that. I never know exactly what to say. I mean, I always feel bad saying, well, I'm really sorry, because I'm not really apologizing. I had nothing to do with it. But you feel that you have to say something. Can you talk about why it is so difficult and maybe how your book addresses this situation?
Yes, it is. There's an awkwardness. It's really, first of all, it's kind of scary. I mean, I can imagine being having something awful happen, and the first thing we can think of is, well, I don't dare go over to their house. You know,
right.
That would be a horrible thing to do. Or I don't dare bring the topic up. I'll give you an example of something. And I think there's a fear if it's a sickness or a death. You know, we're kind of afraid of that whole topic. And then afraid of saying something dumb or something hurtful.
Right.
But I'll give you a little example. I used to work with, or I have in the past, worked with medical residents when I was director of chaplaincy at St. Paul Children's Hospital. And that means they're doctors. They're already doctors. They've come to our hospital for probably a six-week rotation in pediatrics. But these are really, really sick children, and some children for which there is no medicine and there is no cure. And these medical residents were so upset because they didn't dare they were frightened to even go in the room with the family and the siblings and so forth.
Right.
So we sat down and actually talked about that and realized that the first thing they really have to do is go through the door.
Right.
And sit down. And then, from then on, you know, if you can get past that awkwardness and fear that somebody's going to burst out crying or have some kind of a meltdown, you can really come up with some creative ideas. And these residents did. They would ask the parents to bring pictures and tell me, what is your little girl's favorite book? She's on a ventilator, so I can't really see her pretty face. Can you bring me a class picture of her? So a simple conversation about the daily things that would interest a family or an individual, mm-hmm. whether it's a death or a job, just saying to somebody, what hurts the most about what's happened? Can you tell me that?
Right.
And I believe the person is very likely to tell you. But I think we get so self-conscious about what we're going to say or what kind of a dumb mistake we're going to make that we don't realize that maybe I just need to put a post-it note on the refrigerator telling them I love them and call it square.
Right.
So keeping it simple is helpful.
Okay.
And asking what it is they need and what you might be able to do to help with that.
Okay.
So I don't think it's magic, but it is. It does take some courage, because that walking through the door is the first step, and that can be pretty scary, and it is for anybody, even if they've had experience at it.
Exactly. And sometimes we have to walk through that door, because avoiding it, that's when they need you the most, you know? So
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, with that in mind, what's the other side of the coin? When you're dealing with somebody here, you know, you mentioned saying respectful things. What are some of the things that you should avoid that you might inadvertently offer that is not good? Can you offer some suggestions for ways to avoid that?
I can, and there really are many. And again, it has to do with honoring the person and then the grief itself. So, for example, telling somebody, to say to somebody, oh, look how well you're doing. God wouldn't give you more than you could handle. I know that. Well, frankly, that person is likely to think, the heck with that.
Right.
I've got more than I can handle, and I'm not doing well at all.
Absolutely.
So, one of the most difficult, I've seen two of the most difficult things, and that, well, for example, a child whose sibling has died,
mm-hmm.
Somebody might say, well, you know, Jesus loved that child so sure, that your sister, that he just had to, you know, take her up there and have her be with him. Now, nobody would mean harm by that, but imagine the other child going to bed at night and thinking, well, I'm afraid to go to sleep for fear I might get taken away.
Yeah.
You know, if Jesus likes me too. Or with a woman who's lost a baby, that's another really difficult area. And usually, you know, she's probably young. She's probably able to get pregnant again. But that comment is not a helpful one to stay home, you know, go home and get pregnant again. You're young, you're healthy. All true, but not helpful. And not giving the person the space to acknowledge, you know, again, how does this hurt the most? That you won't be able to make memories with this child, or you feel like you've lost a part of yourself. They're apt to tell you much more than you expected, but by simply asking, can you tell me where you hurt the most and where I can be helpful? And I think you'll get answers.
You have often said that a person does not need to be a hospital chaplain to help ease a bereavement situation. When someone has experienced a life-changing loss or some major event, what little things can make a difference? I mean, what can you do, you know, not necessarily a grand gesture, but just little things throughout the day that can you do that will help them ease the pain?
Well, I think there are a number of things. As I mentioned before, I don't believe loss is about a single thing. So, for example, that person who lost the job now doesn't have anybody to have coffee with in the morning.
Right.
Now doesn't get many phone calls. probably doesn't get to go to happy hour, or at least, you know, all the kind of things that go with the work.
Right.
Not to mention the challenge of trying to find a new job. So I think just thinking about what happens when something, some big upheaval happens. People get divorced, and oftentimes one of the partners loses all the friendships. They all go, you know, everybody kind of either not necessarily sides with, but is more comfortable with one or the other. And now one of them has to create all new friendships.
Right.
So a simple, and again, I don't mean to make it simplify it, because
right.
it isn't, you know, a simple thing. But I just think the one thing that I have seen over the years is when somebody has something occurs that is really a horrible setback or terribly upsetting, they often feel out of control.
Mm-hmm.
And they are out of control.
Sure.
Something has happened that they have not been able to control. And even the smallest amount of coming up with ideas that can help somebody feel more in control. I remember going to see a woman whose child had been hit by a drunk driver. And everybody was getting ready and killed. And the whole family was getting ready to go to the funeral. And this woman was not even dressed. She was out in the garden weeding in her nightgown.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, that's exactly what she needs to do. She needs to manage something.
Right.
And that's exactly what she was doing. So helping people come up with, again, small steps, clean their house. You know, take the children for an afternoon, or if it's somebody who's single, make sure they're not sitting home alone every night, which doesn't mean you have to take them to a concert or chase them around and, you know, downtown and making them go out for dinner every other minute. But they might want to go up to the lake for the weekend.
Right.
Or go to a ball game or something. And just remember that if that person has had a real setback, either they, you know, they now have lost all of their routines or their job or another person that they care about. And so just how would you like to be treated? I guess that's about the best way to put it.
Sure.
What would I like if my mother has just died and I can't think of anything that I want to do? I can remember when some people brought these old Glenn Miller records to our house.
Mm-hmm.
At my mother's funeral, and everybody ended up dancing. They were her records. And so here we were, you know, at something that wasn't a very happy situation, and
right.
yet it became fun and filled with conversation and joy because she loved music, and these were her records. They were kind of first press, you know, all those LPs that we don't see very often anymore.
Right, right.
So I think, you know, the main thing that happens, it's sort of like being stage fright. You stand up there and you think, oh, my God, I'm going to make a mistake. I'm going to fall off the stage. I'm going to drop the mic. And you kind of forget about why people came. And if you can kind of reverse that when you get sort of stage fright, maybe stage fright is a pretty good word.
Right.
And think, well, what does this group really need? Why have they come here? How nice they invited me. And what is it that I could give them that would make their lives easier,
right.
or better, or right. enlightened?
Right.
Does that make any sense?
Absolutely it does. And this kind of feeds into the whole notion of hope, you know, that light at the end of the tunnel. And I know you've written mm-hmm. about it, and I definitely want to give you a chance to explain that. Now, for me, I'll throw this in. I'm always very careful not to encourage what we might call a false reality. You know,
right.
I'm very careful about not telling someone, well, it's going to be okay, when in fact the situation might be as such that we know it's not going to be okay. Something really bad is about to happen. So what does all this mean to someone who feels an absence of hope? And I wonder if you could explain that a little bit, and how might your interpretation of hope apply to all of life's setbacks and losses?
Well, I think that it helps to think about hope in a little different way.
Okay.
Because there are so many situations, of course things aren't going to be the same. somebody's gone now, or something is gone now. Life has been upended, and now I have to think about what I'm going to do next. There are two things. I think that, you know, our lives are filled with a lot of upheavals. How do we learn? Somebody puts a problem in front of us, and we get creative and come up with a solution. And in many ways, these kinds of losses are similar. Not that we jump on top of it and come up with a bunch of fun and creative ideas, but it does cause us to think, all right, I can't go this direction any longer, or this has totally changed. Mm-hmm. How might I make my life valuable again and worthy and make me want, you know, have me wanting to get up in the morning? So creativity can be an outgrowth of a loss or of a setback. But then the next part of that is, if I indeed, things are not going to be the same. So wishing is, I feel, different than hope. And okay. Wishing, we think of the individual things. I hope I can make a lot of money, or I hope, you know, I can go to Paris or something. But in fact, I see hope as what I would call the assurance of future good.
Okay.
So it might not be the same good,
right?
And it might not be a replacement, but there is good, and we are assured of it. I really believe that.
Right.
So I think it helps to frame hope in that kind of language, so we're not coming up with a wish list so much as we are feeling confident that the light will shine again.
Right.
And there really is dawn after midnight.
Yes. Well, you know, in general, most people, and I'm one of these people, I'm resistant to any kind of change, okay? Even if it's just my schedule during the day. So when you have a major change like that, you know, you have to, I believe you're absolutely right. You have to construct a plan that gives you the fulfillment and a path to continue on that was, you know, that's positive. So I believe that's a very good interpretation of hope. Again,
I think it's helpful because oftentimes people can't think of one wish that you want to wish.
Right.
You know, they just feel kind of empty.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it can be a big challenge. Oh, absolutely. And I've been at that crossroad any number of times, and there's people that have been through a lot worse than I have. And it's always amazing that people can get through some of the situations that they do. And they're an example for all of us. You know, what's going on down with the flooding right now is a perfect example of that. I mean, you know, that you're talking about people whose lives have just been turned upside down. They've lost everything. You know, their home, their place of business a lot of times, where they work. And it can be a very tough road.
Absolutely. It can, and it will be, no doubt, for a while. But I do think, imagine that yourself losing something like that. I think most of us, given the opportunity, can be constructive and can be creative in reshaping our lives in wholesome ways. But, you know, that's why it's so important to pay attention to this, not to hang around and get stuck in a bunch of gloom,
right?
But to give yourself enough time to breathe and to come to grips with what's occurred, and then think about how now can I shape my life in a meaningful way so that I feel that getting up in the morning is worthwhile and I have something to contribute, and I can enjoy living.
Right.
And I think that isn't something you'd say to someone the minute this happens, but I think that my purpose with this little book is to get to the end of it and be able to say to the reader, and as a gift from the person who's offered the book, you know what? There really might be light here. I think I could imagine light here. Not
right.
Today, but at a time, I can believe that.
Sure.
Well, and that's really the point of it. We're not fixing people with this book, but it is a point of transition where maybe it's the first step to help somebody get through that first part and think and realize there really is something ahead that could be worthwhile.
Right. And with so many, like with so many other things, it's oftentimes that first step is the most difficult one. The book is entitled, again, for people listening, the book is entitled, If I Could Mend Your Heart. And it is available on Amazon, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And the author's name is Mary Farr, and that is with two R's, F-A-R-R, if you're going to search Amazon for that. It is available on HO Press, Shorehouse Books. And in closing, is there anything you would like to say to the audience, one parting shot that you would like to give about your, what's the word I'm looking for, your attitude about life in general and the spirit of this book?
Well, I hope that this, I really am looking at this as a gift. I've written several books, and this one I've really drawn from years of meeting families, meeting people from other cultures, working with children. I have a lovely niece who illustrated it so beautifully. We both celebrated our mother's lives. Both of us have lost our mothers. So again, it was meant to be, we have just rejoiced over writing this because we feel that people will love to receive it and they will see it as a gift because that's the way we're offering it.
Right. Now let's give a little shout out. You said someone, your niece or somebody did the cover art, is that correct?
Yes. No, she did all the illustrations and the cover art.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And she lost her mother recently too, just in the last couple of years. And so it's been, fun is not the greatest word, I suppose, but it's been a joy to do this because we really feel that it's something that we would love for somebody to give us. And so therefore we hope and believe that others will enjoy receiving it. And if I were looking for a card and I couldn't find one, or I wanted something more than a card, I would be drawn to this. So that's probably, I don't know, maybe that's just because I wrote it. But I think it says a lot. I think it says a lot that many of us would like to say, but are either too timid or a little frightened to say.
Okay.
So hopefully that's a good thing. I think it's a good thing.
I believe it is a very good thing. A very interesting show today. Mary, I want to thank you very much for being on our podcast today. Again.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
Oh, good.
I've appreciated it.
Okay, and I just wanted to close by saying one more time, the book is entitled If I Could Mend Your Heart by Mary Farr from Shorehouse Books, HO Press. I want to thank all the people out there who listened to our program today. Thank you very much for checking out our podcast. It's been a very interesting show today, very interesting concept to talk about today. Thank you very much, Mary. And with that being said, I want to tell everyone to have a great day, and I hope you check out the book.